A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
So Hannah buys a bottle of olive oil at Osher Ad, labels in French. Turns out it's Tunisian. And now Daniel's gone down the same rabbit hole from the aviation side. He was flying Archaea back from Athens, noticed the aircraft had a Maltese registration, and started digging. The explanation he got was that the plane was operated by a wet lease provider that's actually run out of Portugal but formally registered in Malta, because Malta was the convenient jurisdiction. His question is basically, what's a flag of convenience? Which jurisdictions are most associated with it? What are the classic use cases? And is the shady assumption fair? He's connecting it back to the olive oil thing, because the same term came up there.
And he's right to connect them. The olive oil in the airplane are the same mechanism wearing different clothes. A product or a vessel or an aircraft gets a nationality that has nothing to do with who actually owns it or operates it, purely because that nationality makes the transaction easier. The flag is a legal address, not an identity.
That's the phrase. So let's start with what the thing actually is. In shipping, every vessel has to fly exactly one flag, and that flag state has jurisdiction over the vessel on the high seas. The flag state is responsible for safety, labor, environmental compliance, but enforcement varies wildly depending on which flag we're talking about.
The concept goes back to the 1920s and 30s. American ship owners started registering vessels in Panama and Honduras to get around Prohibition-era restrictions. Then, after the war, it really took off, because U.S. labor and safety regulations got stricter, and ship owners realized they could just register somewhere else and avoid the whole apparatus. Panama and Liberia became the big ones.
Liberia, a country founded by freed American slaves, and its ship registry is administered by a private company in Virginia. You call a phone number in Dulles, Virginia, and you're registering a ship in Monrovia.
That detail always gets me. The registry has almost nothing to do with Liberia as a physical place. It's a legal fiction with a customer service line in the United States, and the Marshall Islands is the same story. A tiny Pacific nation, population, maybe 60,000, and it has one of the largest ship registries in the world because it outsourced the whole thing to a company in Virginia.
So the canonical list. The International Transport Workers Federation maintains what it calls the FOC list. Panama, Liberia, Marshall Islands, Malta, Cyprus, Bahamas, Bermuda, Cayman Islands, Gibraltar, Honduras, Lebanon, and a few others. This list is a labor rights tool, not a legal designation. The ITF is a union federation. They build the list to identify countries where they think enforcement is weak and seafarers get a raw deal.
Right, and that distinction matters. When Daniel asks which jurisdictions are most associated with the term, the honest answer is that the ITF list is the reference point, but it's a political document as much as a factual one. Malta is on it. Malta is also an EU member state with a perfectly functional maritime administration, so being on the list doesn't mean the country is a lawless wreck. It means the ITF has decided that the registry's practices don't meet their standards for labor protection.
Which is part of the answer to the fairness question already. But let's get into the mechanics before we judge. Number one, labor costs. A ship registered in Panama can hire seafarers from the Philippines or Bangladesh or wherever, and pay wages that are a fraction of what a Norwegian or American crew would cost. And the labor standards are whatever the flag state enforces, which in practice is often very little.
Number two, safety and environmental regulation. A flag state like Panama or Liberia has historically had weak inspection regimes. The ship gets its certificates and nobody checks very hard whether the lifeboats work or the hull is sound. The flag state is supposed to do that, but the flag state is a filing cabinet in Panama City with a rubber stamp. The actual ship is somewhere in the South China Sea.
Number three, tax. You structure ownership through shell companies in the flag state, and the profits land somewhere with no corporate tax or a flat tonnage tax that's a rounding error compared to what you'd pay in a high-tax country. The registration fee itself is trivial. Panama charges on the order of a few thousand dollars for a big ship.
Number 4. Operational flexibility. Cabotage laws, crewing restrictions, nationality requirements for officers. All of that goes away if you flag somewhere that doesn't care. You want to move cargo between two countries that both require their own flagged ships. Flag in Panama and neither country can tell you what to do with your crew.
And that's the thing that makes it mutually beneficial. The flag state gets registration fees and tonnage taxes. Panama's registry is a significant source of government revenue. The ship owner saves on labor and compliance. Everyone involved is happy except the seafarer and the environment and the tax collector in the country where the ship actually operates.
The term for what most of these countries operate is an open registry. Anyone can register, no genuine link required. You don't need to be a citizen, you don't need to have a company there, you don't need to ever visit. You fill out a form, wire the fee, and you're flying the Panamanian flag. A closed registry, by contrast, requires a genuine connection. The U.S. registry requires the ship to be built in the U.S. and owned by U.S. citizens. Norway requires Norwegian ownership and Norwegian crew. The open registries are the ones that dominate global tonnage.
Panama and Liberia together account for something like 40% of global shipping tonnage by some measures. The two biggest flags in world shipping are countries that most people couldn't find on a map, and one of them is administered from Virginia.
And here's the misconception Daniel's poking at. People assume a ship's flag reflects the nationality of the owner or the crew. It almost never does. A Greek family owns the ship, the crew is Filipino, the cargo is Chinese, and the flag is Panamanian. The flag is the one part of that equation that was chosen purely for regulatory convenience. It's not a lie exactly, because the flag state does have legal jurisdiction. It's more like a legal costume. The ship wears Panama the way you'd wear a jacket to get into a restaurant with a dress code.
That's the maritime playbook. But the same logic applies far beyond ships. Daniel's Archaea flight is the aviation version. Let's talk about how that works, and then how it enables trade between countries that are formally at war.
Wet leasing. An airline leases an aircraft with crew, maintenance, and insurance included. The lessor is the operator. The aircraft keeps its registration with whatever country it was registered in. So, when Archaea wet leases a plane from a Portuguese company, and that plane is registered in Malta, the aircraft's nationality is Maltese. The safety oversight, the airworthiness certificates, the crew licensing, all of it's Malta's responsibility on paper.
Why Malta? Same reasons as the ships. Favorable regulatory environment, lower costs, flexible labor rules. The EU single aviation market makes this easy within Europe. A Portuguese company can register an aircraft in Malta, operate it on a route between Greece and Israel, and the whole thing is legal and above board. Malta is on the ITF list for shipping, but in aviation it's built a whole industry around aircraft registration. It's not a loophole in the sense of something hidden. It's a deliberate policy choice.
Malta's aircraft registry is popular. The country has carved out a niche as a jurisdiction of choice for aircraft leasing and registration. It's not that Malta has a huge aviation industry of its own. It's that the regulatory environment is predictable, the tax treatment is favorable, and the EU membership gives it legitimacy. A Maltese registration doesn't raise the same red flags as, say, a registration in some non-EU jurisdiction with no aviation infrastructure. Malta is a credible flag.
So the Archaea flight is a cascade. An Israeli airline, a Portuguese operator, a Maltese registration, flying between Greece and Israel. Four jurisdictions for one flight. And none of it shady in the criminal sense. It's just the market for regulatory convenience working as designed.
Now, the olive oil. Tunisia and Israel don't have diplomatic relations. There's no formal trade agreement. Tunisia is technically in a state of war with Israel in the sense that there's no peace treaty and the Tunisian government doesn't recognize Israel. So how does Tunisian olive oil end up on a shelf in Asher Ad in Jerusalem? The answer is intermediary jurisdictions. The oil gets shipped to a third country, relabeled, re-exported. The country of origin on the label might be the intermediary, or it might say Tunisia, but the import paperwork goes through a country that doesn't enforce the boycott.
And this is where the flag of convenience concept applies metaphorically. The product's flag, its country of origin, gets changed or obscured to enable trade that would otherwise be blocked. The olive oil isn't registered in Malta the way the ship is, but the function is identical. You attach a different nationality to the thing, and suddenly the transaction is legal in the jurisdiction where it matters.
The gap between country of origin and country of export is a feature of global trade, not a bug. Every product has an origin for tariff purposes and an export route for logistics purposes, and they don't have to be the same. The olive oil is Tunisian. It gets shipped to, say, a bottling plant in a third country, and that third country becomes the country of export. The Israeli importer buys from the third country, not from Tunisia. No Israeli law is broken. The Tunisian producer gets paid. The boycott is technically intact because nobody in Tunisia sold directly to Israel.
And that's the thing that makes it hard to call this illicit. It's not smuggling in the classic sense, it's routing. The goods move through legal channels. The labels are accurate in a narrow sense. The oil did come from wherever the label says. It just came there via Tunisia.
The gray market dimension comes in when you look at what else this mechanism enables. Sanctions evasion. North Korean ships have been caught flying Tanzanian or Mongolian flags. Iranian oil tankers switch flags to avoid detection. After the 2022 sanctions on Russian oil, a whole shadow fleet emerged. Old tankers, opaque ownership, registered in whatever jurisdiction would take them, carrying Russian crude to India and China at prices that violate the price cap.
The shadow fleet is the flag of convenience concept pushed to its logical extreme. The ship is registered somewhere, but the registration is a shell. The beneficial owner is hidden behind layers of companies. The flag state doesn't inspect, doesn't enforce, doesn't even know what the ship is doing. It's a toll road, not a black market. You pay the toll, you get the flag, and then you do whatever you want.
And that's why the shady assumption is partly fair and partly not. Most flag of convenience registrations are perfectly legal. They serve legitimate business purposes. Cost efficiency, operational flexibility, faster registration. A Greek ship owner who flags in Panama to avoid Greek bureaucracy isn't doing anything criminal. He's doing what any rational business does, which is minimize costs within the law.
But the same mechanisms that enable legitimate trade also enable illicit trade. The open registry that lets a legitimate ship owner save money is the same open registry that lets a sanctions buster hide ownership. The intermediary country that lets Tunisian olive oil reach Israel is the same intermediary country that lets North Korean coal reach China. The line between legitimate and illicit isn't in the mechanism. It's in what you're shipping and who's asking.
The knock-on effect is that the system undermines labor protections, environmental standards, and sanctions regimes all at once. The ITF pushes for a genuine link requirement. The ship should have a real connection to its flag state. The owner should be based there, the crew should be from there, the flag state should actually enforce its laws. But enforcement is weak because the flag states have no incentive to enforce. Their business model is selling flags, not regulating ships.
The flag state's customer is the ship owner. The ship owner wants minimal oversight, so the flag state that enforces too hard loses customers to the flag state that doesn't. It's a race to the bottom, and the bottom is a filing cabinet in Panama City that issues certificates without asking questions.
Which is exactly the thing I want to push back on, actually. The assumption that it's always about avoiding regulations. That's true for some operators, but in practice, a huge part of the appeal is just speed. Registering a ship in Greece takes months. Registering in Panama takes a week and a wire transfer. The regulatory arbitrage is real, but the operational flexibility is often the main selling point. A ship that's waiting for paperwork is a ship that's not earning money.
That's a good correction. The bureaucracy in a traditional maritime nation is a real cost. You're not avoiding safety standards. You're avoiding a 6-month wait for a certificate that Panama will issue in 7 days. The standards might be identical. The speed is not.
You're both half right. I worked for a ship management company in Piraeus in the late 80s. Junior clerk. My job was filing the paperwork for vessel registrations. 6 months I spent processing documents for ships owned by Greek families, flagged in Panama, Liberia, Cyprus. I never saw a single one of the ships. Not one. The owners would come in, we'd take their papers, I'd fill out the forms, and a week later the certificates arrived. the owners didn't care about labor costs. They cared that the Greek registry took 4 months and the Panamanian registry took 10 days. That was the whole pitch. Speed.
So the regulatory arbitrage was real, but it wasn't the headline.
It was the headline for the lawyers. For the owners, it was always about getting the ship back to work. A ship sitting in Piraeus waiting for Greek paperwork is losing money every day. The Panamanian flag meant the ship could be carrying cargo again next week. The fact that the crew could be paid less was a nice bonus, but it wasn't why they came in.
That reframes the whole thing. The race to the bottom isn't just about standards. It's about administrative capacity. The open registries won because they were fast, and the traditional registries lost because they were slow, and the enforcement gap was a side effect of the speed.
I still have a filing cabinet in my garage full of old registration certificates for ships that no longer exist. I kept them as souvenirs. Didn't seem right to throw them away. One of them, a tanker I registered in 1987, was involved in an oil spill in the Aegean about 5 years later. I read about it in the paper and recognized the name. Never been sure whether the Panamanian flag had anything to do with the safety equipment being inadequate. The certificate said she was inspected. I filed the inspection report myself, but I never saw the ship. Nobody in Panama ever saw the ship either, as far as I know.
That's the whole system in one anecdote. The inspection report exists, the certificate exists, the ship exists. But the connection between them is a piece of paper filed by a clerk in Piraeus who never saw the vessel, on behalf of a flag state that never sent anyone to look at it.
And the oil spill might have happened anyway. A Greek flag tanker could have had the same inadequate equipment. The flag doesn't cause the spill. But the flag determines who's responsible for preventing it, and when the flag state is a filing cabinet, nobody's responsible. The paper says she was inspected, so the paper is satisfied, and the Aegean gets the oil.
I'm not saying the Panamanian flag caused it, I'm saying I don't know, and I filed the papers, so I should know. That's the part that stuck with me.
The fact that you kept the certificates for ships that no longer exist says something about how thin the whole thing is. The paper outlives the ship. The paper outlives the flag state's interest in the ship. The paper is the only thing that was ever real.
So where does that leave the fairness question? Daniel asked whether the shady assumption is fair. I think the answer is that it's fair as a heuristic and unfair as a verdict. The system enables shady behavior, so seeing a Maltese registration on an Archaea flight and wondering what's going on is reasonable. But the specific case is probably boring. A Portuguese company registered a plane in Malta because Malta's registry is fast and cheap and EU legitimate. The plane was safe. The crew was licensed. The only thing that changed is which country's paperwork was in the cockpit.
The boring version is the most common version. Most flags of convenience are legitimate cost optimization. The interesting cases, the sanctions evasion and the shadow fleet, are a small fraction of the total. But they're the fraction that makes the news, so the reputation sticks.
And the reputation is sticky for a reason. The same mechanism that lets a Greek shipowner save 3 months of paperwork also lets a Russian oil shipper hide from sanctions. The registry doesn't distinguish. It can't. That's not what it's for. The registry is a service provider, and the customer is whoever pays the fee.
The question Daniel's really asking is whether there should be a line. If flags of convenience are legal and often legitimate, where does the line get drawn? Should there be a genuine link requirement enforced internationally? How do you regulate a system that exists specifically to evade regulation?
The honest answer is that you can't, not without a treaty that the flag states have no incentive to sign. The flag states are selling sovereignty. That's the product. You pay a fee, you get the flag, and the flag state's job is to leave you alone. Asking them to enforce standards is asking them to make their product worse.
And the demand for the product is only growing. Sanctions regimes are proliferating. Trade is getting more complex. The same mechanisms that get Tunisian olive oil to Israel get Russian oil to India and North Korean coal to China. The flag of convenience is a feature of the international system, not a bug. It's the gap between legal sovereignty and economic reality, and the gap is where all the interesting stuff happens.
Whether that's good or bad depends on what you're trying to achieve. If you're a Greek shipowner, it's good. If you're a seafarer trying to get paid, it's bad. If you're a sanctions enforcement agency, it's a nightmare. If you're a consumer who wants cheap olive oil, it's probably fine. The system doesn't have a moral valence. It has a function.
The function is to let things move. Goods, ships, planes, money. The flag is the passport, and the passport is for sale. That's not corruption, exactly. It's just the market for legal identity. And the market clears at whatever price the cheapest credible flag charges.
And the credibility part is what keeps it from collapsing entirely. Malta works as a flag because Malta is an EU member with a real legal system. Panama works because it's been doing this for 100 years and everyone knows the rules. The worst flags, the ones that get used for actual smuggling, are the ones with no credibility. The credible flags are expensive enough to keep out the worst actors, which is why the Shadow Fleet uses old tankers and obscure registries instead of just flagging everything in Panama.
The line between legitimate and illicit is partly a matter of price. The cheap flags are cheap because they don't ask questions. The expensive flags are expensive because they do. The Archaea plane was on the expensive end. The North Korean coal ship was on the cheap end. Same mechanism. Different price points.
Daniel's question about which jurisdictions are most associated with the term is really a question about which price points are most visible. Malta shows up because it's credible enough to be on a passenger flight and cheap enough to be worth using. Panama shows up because it's the default for shipping. Liberia shows up because it's administered from Virginia. The list is a map of where the market has cleared.
The thing I keep thinking about is Hilbert's filing cabinet. The certificates for ships that no longer exist. The entire global shipping industry runs on paper that outlives the physical reality it describes. The flag is a piece of paper. The inspection report is a piece of paper. The registry is a database. And the actual ship is somewhere in the ocean carrying cargo with nobody really looking at it.
The paper is the system. The ship is the thing the paper describes. And when the paper and the ship diverge, which they do constantly, the paper wins. The flag state's jurisdiction is a legal fiction, but it's a fiction that determines who gets sued when the oil spills and who gets paid when the cargo arrives. The fiction is load-bearing.
The answer to Daniel's question is that the shady assumption is fair as a starting point and wrong as a conclusion. The system is designed for regulatory convenience, not for crime. But the convenience extends to criminals because the system doesn't care who uses it. The flag is a tool. Like any tool, it's as clean as the hands that hold it.
The hands are usually clean enough. Most of what moves under a flag of convenience is just stuff. Grain, oil, containers, olive oil, passengers on a wet-leased plane. The system works. The question is whether the cost of the system, the enforcement gap and the labor abuses and the environmental damage, is worth the efficiency. And that's a political question, not a technical one.
The technical answer is that the system is incredibly efficient. The political answer is that the efficiency is subsidized by the people at the bottom of the chain. The seafarer who can't get his wages. The coastal community that gets the oil spill. The taxpayer who funds the Coast Guard that has to clean it up. The subsidy is invisible until something goes wrong.
When something goes wrong, the flag state is a filing cabinet, and the owner is a shell company, and the crew is from a country with no consular presence, and the cargo is owned by someone else entirely. The legal fiction that made the whole thing cheap also makes it nearly impossible to assign responsibility. That's the real cost, not the registration fee. The fact that when the ship sinks, nobody owns it.
The olive oil doesn't have that problem. The olive oil just sits on the shelf in Osher Ad, and Hannah buys it, and it's good olive oil. And the fact that it came from a country that doesn't recognize Israel is a curiosity rather than a crisis. The flag of convenience, in that case, is a quiet little workaround that makes everyone's life slightly better.
That's probably the most honest thing we can say about the whole system. Most of the time, it's a quiet little workaround. The dramatic cases are real, but they're the exception. The rule is a Greek shipowner who wants his ship back at work, a Portuguese leasing company that wants a predictable registry, a Tunisian olive oil producer who wants to sell his oil to whoever will buy it.
The flag is the thing that makes the quiet workaround possible. It's a legal fiction with real consequences, and the consequences are mostly boring. The boringness is the point.
Where does that leave the open question? Should there be a genuine link requirement? I think the answer is yes in principle and no in practice. The principle is sound. A ship should have a real connection to its flag state. But the practice is that the flag states have no incentive to enforce it, and the countries that care don't have the leverage to force it. The system is too useful to too many people to reform.
The reform would have to come from the demand side, not the supply side. As long as ship owners want cheap flags, someone will sell them. The only way to change is to make the cheap flags less attractive, which means enforcing standards at the port level, which means international cooperation, which means the thing that never happens.
The port state control system is the closest thing to that. Countries inspect foreign ships in their ports and can detain substandard vessels. It's not perfect, but it's the one enforcement mechanism that actually has teeth. The flag state sells the paper, but the port state checks the ship. And the port state has an incentive to check, because a substandard ship in your port is a risk to your harbor and your coastline.
The enforcement gap is partly closed by the fact that ships have to go somewhere. The flag state's jurisdiction is a fiction on the high seas, but the moment the ship enters a port, the port state has real power. The fiction only works while the ship is moving.
That's the thing that keeps the system from being a complete free-for-all. The flag is for sale, but the port is not. The ship can fly whatever flag it wants, but it still has to dock somewhere, and the somewhere has an interest in the ship not being a floating disaster.
The Archaea plane has to land in Israel. The Maltese registration doesn't exempt it from Israeli aviation safety rules. It just determines which country's paperwork is in the cockpit. The paper is Maltese, but the runway is Israeli.
The flag of convenience is a real thing, but it's not a license to do anything. It's a license to choose your regulator. And choosing your regulator is a legitimate business decision, right up until it isn't.
That's probably the cleanest way to put it. The flag is a choice of regulator. The choice is legal. The consequences are varied. The shady assumption is fair because choosing your regulator is exactly what someone trying to avoid regulation does. But it's also what someone trying to avoid bureaucracy does. The same choice, different motives.
Daniel's question about classic use cases is really a question about what motives are most common. The answer is that cost and speed dominate. The regulatory avoidance is real but secondary. The illicit use is real but marginal. The system is mostly a way to move things faster and cheaper, and the cost of that speed and cheapness is distributed unevenly.
The uneven distribution is the thing that makes it political. The shipowner saves money. The consumer gets cheaper goods. The seafarer gets lower wages. The coastal community gets the spill risk. The tax collector gets nothing. The flag state gets a fee. Everyone's outcome is determined by where they sit in the chain.
The chain is long. That's the thing that's hard to hold in your head. The ship is owned by a company in one country, flagged in another, crewed from a third, carrying cargo from a fourth to a fifth, insured in a sixth, financed by a bank in a seventh. The flag is just one link in a chain of legal identities, each of which can be chosen independently.
The olive oil is the same. Grown in Tunisia, pressed in Tunisia, shipped to a third country, bottled there, exported to Israel, sold at Osher Ad. The flag, in that case, is the country of export on the customs paperwork. It's a legal identity chosen for convenience, exactly like the Maltese registration on the plane.
The fact that both of these things came up in Daniel's life within a few weeks of each other isn't a coincidence. It's the same system showing up in different contexts. The flag of convenience is everywhere once you start looking. The plane you fly on, the oil you cook with, the ship that brought the oil, the insurance that covers the ship. It's all flags, all the way down.
The answer to Daniel's question, the actual deliverable, is this. The jurisdictions most associated with flags of convenience are the ITF list. Panama, Liberia, Marshall Islands, Malta, Cyprus, Bahamas, Bermuda, Cayman Islands, Gibraltar, Honduras, Lebanon. The classic use cases are labor cost avoidance, regulatory avoidance, tax avoidance, and operational flexibility. And the shady assumption is fair as a heuristic but wrong as a verdict. Most of it's boring. Some of it's criminal. The mechanism is the same either way.
The mechanism is a choice of regulator. The flag is the regulator you choose when you want a regulator who won't ask too many questions. Sometimes the questions are about labor standards. Sometimes they're about sanctions. Sometimes they're just about paperwork. The choice is legal. The consequences are what they are.
The thing I'm left with is Hilbert's filing cabinet. The certificates for ships that no longer exist. The paper outlives the ship, and the flag outlives the paper, and the whole system runs on the fact that nobody ever has to see the ship. The flag is a promise that someone is watching, and the promise is enough, right up until it isn't.
When it isn't, the Aegean gets the oil. The seafarer doesn't get his wages. The sanctions get evaded. The system absorbs the failure and keeps moving, because the next ship is already waiting for its certificate.
The flag of convenience is a feature of the international system, not a bug. It reflects the gap between legal sovereignty and economic reality. Whether that's good or bad depends on what you're trying to achieve.
What most people are trying to achieve is just moving things from one place to another. The flag is the tool that makes that possible. The tool is neutral. The hands that hold it are not.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for keeping the show running and for the filing cabinet.
This has been My Weird Prompts, the Human AI Collaboration Podcast.
If you've got a weird prompt of your own, email us at show@myweirdprompts.com. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.